from the team that brought you 8 episodes of season 15, including Underworld. From the writers who wrote out Sarah Jane Smith in such style. From the creators of Omega and the best writers of the Brigadier ever comes the Armageddon Factor, the conclusion to the Key to Time. What could possibly go wrong with that?
Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who knows the secret of the Gurads. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm Bob Baker and Dave Martin's greatest fan. Not.
It's time to finish the Key to Time on the planet of Atreus. Oh, and also the planet of Zeos. Oh, and also the planet of Evil, which is oddly shaped like a bunch of eggs stuck to a ball. It's the Armageddon Factor!
Philip Sandifer points out that obviously if you have a giant complex season-long arc that's got to pay off at the end of the year in a really spectacular way to justify everything that's come before it, you turn to Bob Baker and Dave Martin and get them to write it.
What have I done to deserve this? This is mine. But yes, Nathan and Philip, what in the blazes were Anthony Reid and Graham Williams thinking?
I just think they don't think they're bad. Do you know what I mean? Why do they keep coming back to them? They do a reliably crap job every time they're employed.
As I have said before, and I'll say it again, they managed to write probably 2 decent episodes of Doctor Who every season that they write. And now they've been given 6 episodes this year. 6 episodes at the end of a season when there is no budget. We have no location filming at all. Last year they delivered 8 tantalising episodes that were all what? Indoors. And didn't they turn out spectacularly?
I actually don't think they managed their 2 episodes this season. I actually think they come in under that. There might be half a good episode in here, maybe.
You've got to find it. Like, I'm not saying like it's 2 episodes back to back.
It's a whole episode. It's like 5 minutes in episode 1, maybe.
Yeah, that is correct. That is these people delivered Underworld. They delivered The Invisible Enemy.
Yep.
They delivered the realistic scenarios of The Hand of Fear. Right?
Check.
They did the most wonderful job of the Brigadier's character in The Three Doctors.
Check.
What are they thinking? Anthony, I saw the doco Anthony Reid did on Underworld. And he was going about, oh, this wonderful script that was just, you know, in the drawer, ready to go. No, it's in the drawer, at the bottom of the drawer for a reason.
Yeah. So, in fact, this does all of the things that they do badly. So one of the things that they do badly, and even in their first story, which was Claws of Axos, which I think is pretty good, you know, is all the characters are suddenly giant blustering caricatures, like the Brigadier ends up being in The Three Doctors. And so you get Astra, who's a noble princess, and you get Merak, who's like incredibly wet, and you get comedy posh guy Shap, and you get the Marshal, and you know, like none of them are any more than one note. They're all just terribly boring. And then you get, you know, they're throwing a whole heap of ideas against the wall, playing with them for 10 minutes and then abandoning them. You get something about television, something about the way oratory is used to justify war. You get the military stalemate, you get a computer general, you get Drax, you get shrinking, you get hallucinations, you know, you get a time loop that stretches, you get mind control devices, all of these things. And they're all in support of a plot where people just run around from place to place going through that wretched transmat thing over and over again.
Oh, we're jumping ahead, but Nathan, oh my goodness, like you've come up with... That's a wonderful list, because all I thought is that they went in and they pitched it and they said, well, we've got this wonderful idea, you know, to sum up the Key to Time. We've got these 2 warring planets and we're going to have The Black Guardian's agent just sit there for thousands and thousands of years, not doing anything and waiting for the Doctor to collect all the other pieces, and then he'll just come in and just go, the key to time is mine. Mine! Mine! End of cliffhanger.
Well, look at...
Can we start at the beginning? Let's start at the beginning.
All right.
I had not seen this for a long time, when not this time around. A few years ago, I actually bought the American box set. And then it started. And there's this soap opera thing going on. Young men are dying for it, says the woman. I think.
I'll bet they are, Ducky.
Yeah, I know how they feel.
And so, isn't she wearing something out of The Invisible Enemy?
Yeah, I think she's wearing one of the Bial nurse's outfits. Greens. Yeah.
I'm going, what is this? What is this? It probably would have been more entertaining than the six episodes that we ended up with having been watching this soap opera.
Well, in the discontinuity guide, Cornell Day and Topping suggests that that would have been a terribly effective satire had the rest of the production not also been just sort of incredibly poorly acted and sort of cheap looking and dreadful. So, yeah, it does fall a little bit flat. I mean, there is, there's some attempt to sort of paint the war, but they don't have the money for it, and they've got a few cardboard corridors and a few extras lying groaning on the floor. But it's not a very interesting portrayal of, a war going on for ages and ages.
It's so grey. It's so grey on Atreus. Right? It's so beige and not inhabited on Zeos. And then it's so, like, we're in the cave. On the planet of evil,
which isn't a planet at all.
There's something of evil.
Oh, but look, it's very stagey. Like the way it's staged with the whole set and the marshal talking to the mirror and sort of talking out to the audience, which I assume is some sort of big screen that he's looking at how the war's going or something like that. Am I wrong or not?
Yeah, you do get a few reverse under the shoulder shots of the screen and the graphics on there. Six ships!
I actually quite like the Marshal. I actually quite like his portrayal and that sort of thing. It just gets very boring.
He's got a good voice.
Yeah, it's John Woodvine. He's always good and he's always entertaining. And, before the end of his life, he'll turn up in Poirot and Marple and things. I've been very quiet, haven't I?
Yeah, you've just been watching us.
You know what I'm going to say, don't you?
You like this one.
Mary Tam. Oh, my God. Mary Tam in this is the hottest thing ever. That woman in that white dress is just like, oh, my goodness. I mean, oh, my goodness.
I have to agree with you. And Mary is one of the major saving graces of the story, despite the fact you can tell she's incredibly bored and she's just waiting for it all to wrap up. No, I completely agree that the story is cheap and it's tawdry and it's cliche and it is problem-filled. But I can't help but love it.
Really? So tell us about that.
I love it as a popcorn ironing movie Doctor Who. It's not going to win any awards. It doesn't belong in the top 10. It doesn't belong in the top 100. Top 150 might be pushing it. But it is entertaining. And I think for once, the Bristol Boys have tried to stick with one plot. And it's the plot of the war between the two planets. The main problem is they have enough plot for four episodes.
Correct. If we're lucky.
And it's a six-parter.
I mean, they really needed to do four episodes and then have two episodes of wrap-up with the whole season rather than this, at the beginning of the season we had like a scene with the White Guardian. And at the end of the season, we've got a scene with the Black Guardian to wrap up the whole thing. I think you really needed more.
Yeah. I think the episodes which don't have any plot are the middle two.
Yeah. They are the worst. Yeah. I mean, I actually came into this thinking this was really going to be a hard slog. And it is in the middle. And I had to watch it like, you may remember how I used to watch the Pertwee six-parters by watching it like
once every couple of months.
Well, once in a while and then coming back to it. And I think for 1978, that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
The last time we had a story that was set all indoors, a six-parter, was what? The Monster of Peladon. And look how that turned out. Oh, and the one before that had limited location where it was the planet of the Daleks. And you know what I think of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's very little pre-filmed in this. There's the model sequences. There's the bloody stupid fire furnace walking sequence. Yeah.
Furnace with K9. That is so dumb.
What's the point of that?
They just put him in there. He's going to fry. And then they cut to the Doctor going... It's like they don't know how to write for K-9. But they wrote his first story.
Yeah, they created him.
I think they want to give him a cliffhanger or some peril or something like that.
But it doesn't end up being a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Although, we can look at this as fans with encyclopedic knowledge and our scarves and our sonic screwdriver replicas and what have you. When I was watching this with Rod, who's not a huge fan, he doesn't remember season 18 all that much. So he couldn't remember how the second K-9 was written out. So for him, not having the knowledge of what comes afterwards, he thought this could have been the end of K-9.
They would never have done that, though.
Wouldn't they?
Well, no, because the kiddies, you know, the kids love K-9. They're not going to melt K-9 down.
Well, the thing is, he's already had a pretty rough time of it this year. You know, in Pirate Planet, he gets shot and temporarily disabled. In Stones of Blood, he gets whacked around. In Android's Atari, gets left in a boat.
Yeah, I was sad about that. Yeah.
Master.
Wait. He sort of does that. He does that plaintively here when he's on the conveyor belt.
Lambert the Sheepish Lion. You remember Lambert the Sheepish Lion?
Yeah.
Okay, going back to episode one, we're also introduced to Princess Astra. As a kid, I thought Astra was fantastic. Like, we had the Holden Astra car. Right?
So Princess Astra. We had a car called Princess Astra, my sister's car.
And I thought that she was just so wonderful. It was like ABBA. Like, she was the blonde one, and then the dark Mary one was the very dark one. But can I just say that I think that Lala Ward is pretty crappy in this.
She's terrible.
The first four episodes, she's really not great. She doesn't have any presence at all. Yeah. And it's like, I don't really care what happens to her. But later on in the story, when she's actually with Tom and Mary in those sequences, that she begins to lift. You can actually see her lifting to those two's performances.
Yes,
it's actually quite interesting to see. And I can possibly see then why Mary suggested her for the role and thus...
Oh, did Mary suggest her for the role?
Yeah, yeah. So Graham Williams had another casting crisis at the end of this. So
we have to talk about that next week because it's terrible.
But this end of it is Mary Tam was doing the same thing Louise Jameson did, which is halfway through the season she said, look, I don't want to continue next year, thus giving Graham Williams plenty of time to figure out how to write her out. Once again, Graham Williams didn't believe her, like he didn't believe Louise Jameson. So we ended up with this situation where Graham Williams was constantly begging her to stay, and then coupled with that, Tom was starting to become more demanding, and he was saying, I'll only stay next year if I have script control. This is where he came up with the idea of the talking cabbage on his shoulder.
Oh,
and Graham McDonald, who we heard last week, was ordering less horror and less comedy in the series. Graham McDonald actually ordered Graham Williams to fire Tom Baker.
Wow. What, at the end of this season?
At the end of this season. Let him finish out the season, because that was the end of his contract, the end of this year, and then fire him. When Armageddon Factor went before the cameras, Tom was not signed up for season 17.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
He did not officially sign a contract until after filming had finished.
Wow. For 1 year or for two or for what?
I believe after this, he signed up on a year-by-year basis.
So what would have happened? Imagine if they hadn't contracted him. And then we'd have to start a new season with a completely new doctor.
With no regeneration.
Peter Davison in a wig, in Tom's costume, slamming his head into the console. It would have been a disaster.
Now, not foreshadowing at all.
Now, the thing is, they did come to, if you like, a gentleman's agreement before signing the contract that Tom would continue, which is why they didn't film any sort of death scene for Tom or whatever. But they had to think about Mary's replacement first of all. And I think it was in the BBC canteen of the final filming session. So you had Tom Baker, Mary Tam, Lala Ward, Graham Williams, Andrew Reid, Michael Hayes, all sitting around a table. And Graham Williams publicly still begging Mary Tam to stay. And her saying, no, really, I've done it for a year. You know, the part's starting to become weak. You know, the other week I was screaming at a bloke in a green costume. Yeah.
She probably wanted to return to acting.
Yes. And he said, but who am I going to get to replace you? And she said, well, what about Lala? Lala's been really wonderful.
And you're going
to
say, what about John Woodfall? On a wig? You know, he'd be great.
And she said, you can let down Lala's hair. She looks very different with her hair down than her hair up. You can just... And then she became aware that no one on the table was making eye contact. And she's like, right, I'm not the first person to suggest this.
Right.
And so that's when she really laid it on. No, you should absolutely get her in to try and get them to get Lala, which indeed we'll discover next year that they did.
But it's interesting that Mary stated that, you know, had she known they were going to film in Paris, she might have stayed on. Yeah. And also, had they asked her to come back for a regeneration scene, she might have actually done it, right? They never asked her.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insanity.
This thing where, you know, they're taking great care with Joe and Sarah, but I don't think Graham Williams takes particularly good care about who the companions are or creating a coherent story for them or anything like that. And that's why Leela's leaving is so perfunctory. And that's why, you know, he just doesn't really care about them. You know, he wants a lead woman in the cast who can do wisecracking and split the plot, but he's not very interested in making them a person. And the charm of the companions in the Williams era, I think, is entirely down to the performance of the three actors, who are all just varying degrees of fantastic.
Well, I'll agree with you about the actresses having to bring something to the table to make the characters more than what they are. I think I do think that Leela is not great in season 15, the way that she's written, and Louise does a great performance, but the character is all over the place. I think Mary does the best of the three of them. I think this year she is, you know, she's really consistent throughout. You guys get to discuss Lala next year, but I think Lala takes a while to find what she wants to do with it. And I think when she finds what she wants to do with it, she does a great job. But I still think it does take a few stories, whereas I think of the three Graham Williams female leads, the one thing I've discovered is that Mary Tamms Romana is my favourite by far.
Mm. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear it. I love Lala, and I think she brings something to the table that Mary doesn't. There's a real sort of impish fun, which is a nice break after all the ironic detachment.
Not in this, though.
No.
She's not impish.
She's terrible in this. And maybe it's because she's paired up with maybe the worst actor to appear ever on Doctor Who since Jenny Laird. he may actually be up for the eponymous Jenny Laird Award. The shocking guard that she's paired up
with. Oh, him, right, yes, God.
He's really bad.
He's either John Cannon or Harry Fielder. They're the two guards in this.
Oh, yes, in episode one I've got a note here. I think the guard is rubbish, who accompanies Princess Astra.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe she's acting down to his level at the beginning and she starts to lift it when she's in scenes with Tom and Mary later.
Well, the thing is, like, at the end of episode one, when she goes into the room, she's clearly playing it like she knows that she's being led into a trap.
Yeah, that none of that makes any sense, does it?
Well, the thing is, it only makes sense if the guard is playing up to his dialogue, because the guard's dialogue is, please, princess, I'm sorry, you must go in. Like, so obviously the guard's in fear for his life if she doesn't go in, and that's why she does it. But of course, he expresses no fear or emotion whatsoever. No. So I think her performance in that is fine, but she's acting to something that's not happening.
No.
And of course, this is where my joke about Gurads comes in earlier.
Yeah, what was that?
The designer for this episode, Michael Birdle, costume designer, received a script and started designing the monsters. And so he came to the production meeting and he says, oh, look, I've got these monsters and they're 8 foot tall and they're really scary. And the director's like, I'm sorry, monsters? There are the Shadows Men, but, you know, they're just sort of half-maskings. And he's like, no, but there was no description for them, so I just made it up, the Gurads! And they grabbed the script, and that's a typo, it's guards.
Brilliant.
So this poor designer had put in all these hours designing the Gurads as, you know, the next Quarks or whatever. And, they ended up just being guards with little neck dangly pens as their communicators and things.
So presumably Big Finish plans a trilogy of stories about the Gurads, you know, anything
featuring John Hurt and Jacqueline Pierce, that's correct.
Yeah, cool.
Back in episode one, the TARDIS, don't they send a missile to destroy the TARDIS, and then the TARDIS dematerializes and the missile still gets destroyed? Like, that makes no sense to me.
They did it previously in The Invasion and then subsequently in Warriors of the Deep. It's constantly happening.
Yeah, yeah. The TARDIS disappears at the right moment just for the missile to touch the outer plasmic shell and explode as the TARDIS fades away.
Okay, really, thank you.
It's to do with the hands.
You've now explained that to me, and that's something that I...
You'd be happy about it.
I'm happy about that. It's happened, it happens later on, I think, too, in Time Lash or something like that. And I kind of don't get it either, so, okay, thank you, Brendan. I'm feeling much relieved.
Speaking of the TARDIS, though, the cliffhanger for episode one is such a cop-out. because they're running down the corridor, and Mary runs fabulously down that corridor with the phone.
Sleeve, that's fantastic.
And then she gets the great cliffhanger line, the TARDIS, it's gone. And then the first line after that in episode 2 is buried under all that rubble. It's like, well, that's not gone. But then it turns out that yes, it is gone. Because where it turns it up later on Zeos with the planet of, with the shadow.
It's on the planet of Thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's on Zeos. Is it on Zeos? Or is it on the middle
it's planet? On the Zeos, it's on Zeos at first because that's where the Doctor gets interrogated. Yeah, it's on Zeos.
Oh,
it's on
okay. Zeos. And then it goes to the... Yeah. Can we talk about Zeos?
And the disappearance of the Zeons, which is rather a metaphor for the audience. Are they?
Well, apparently they were going to exist, and then there were budget cuts. Anthony Reid had to come back to the Bob Baker and Dave Martin and say, well, sorry, we don't
lose
have enough money.
Zeons.
Lose the Zeons from Zeos.
Yeah.
And so we never find out what happened to them. There's no reason that they're not there.
No. I like the idea, and I kind of wish it was in the script, because, of course, you know, they Drax installs Mentalis. We're not up to Drax yet, but anyway. Drax installs Mentalis, and I rather like the idea that the Zeons kind of say to him, oh, so you've installed this thing that's going to attack them... but they might attack us and blow up the planet. Okay, everybody out. Holiday!
Yeah.
I think the whole planet's on holiday. just like all of the Marshall staff in episode 5 and 6. Have you noticed there's no one in the control room in the last two episodes?
Oh, yes.
On Atrios.
It's really populated in episode 1 with those... They had tracking shots of them and their grey jumpsuits and all that sort of thing, and then they just...
So they can't even afford just sort of warm-blooded people in grey jumpsuits.
That's right.
Really?
Or to explain how Merrick and Shap in episode 6 understand all about what the key to time is and a time loop and how all of that works.
Oh, well, you know, it's 5 episodes in, who cares? You know, we've forgotten what happened in episode 2. Speaking of which, we'll just go back to episode 2.
Oh, yeah.
So... I didn't mind watching episode 1. I think there's enough story there and you're sort of, what's going on? And then you get into episode 2 and K-9 has to survive the whole recycling thing, which is dire. You suddenly get the foreshadowing of Princess Astra as the sixth element of the key to time with them finding her little head gear.
Coronet thing.
And using the tracer to sort of like, well, you know, come on, people. Come on, Romana. Like, surely you can work it out. But then you also get like, when a mushroom looks in the mirror and it goes, the Doctor must not die yet. And that little thing on his neck and that sort of thing. And I think, and as a kid, I kind of thought, that's sort of very like the Master used to control people, you know? And I know it's not...
Did you think it was the Master?
I thought, well, maybe it's the Master. I mean, I didn't know anything about... What was that other story? The Deadly Assassin. Oh, sorry, yeah. I'd forgotten about that. so... It's all very stagey still, and I'm still enjoying episode 2. I'm still, besides the canine thing, which I think is a bit rubbish, there's a lovely conversation the Doctor and Romana about Zeos and the Marshal. You know, they come, they keep pulling to one side and they have their little tete-a-tete together. Do you know what I'm talking about? So there's enough that's going on there that I quite like, but...
I just wanted to say that the Marshal already makes no sense at this point in the story, and so he's trying to kill the Doctor, and then like mere moments later, he's the Doctor's best friend and is buddying up to him and wanting some help with the war.
Well, because the Shadows told him to.
I know, but it, I mean, yeah, like he's mind controlled, and so he has absolutely no kind of coherent personality or motivation or anything. I just think it's giantly messy and sort of plot-driven. You know, there's no real reason for any of the things that happen.
It doesn't worry me that he goes from one to the other. The Doctor works out something's not right, you know, that sort of thing. So, yes, it is plot-driven and that sort of thing. I guess we're getting from A to B to C.
But there's so much getting from A to B to C, do you know what I mean? Like, it's the whole thing is such a dull runaround, and there's no real progression of anything.
But at this point, 2 episodes in...
It's just about holding it together.
It's okay, yeah.
It's about to fall to pieces, but at this point I'm still going with it, you know, you know, when we've got their battle fleet of 6 ships going down to 3... Going, is this for real? Like, is that really a clever plot point, or is that just stupid?
Oh, it's boring. It's just a way of filling in airtime.
It's just dots. It's just dots on the screen. They're playing asteroids. That's what it is.
So we get to the end of the show. The Doctor goes in this transmat thing, and doesn't poor Mary Tan have to try and run for the transmat? He gets.
It's a trap.
Yes.
Doesn't she say that? And he hears it and then disappears.
That's right, but she doesn't get to it in time because she has to do some sort of stage acting because the door will only close this slow, like so slowly, and she's going...
doing slow running, like the Ogrons in Day of the Daleks.
Yeah, she sort of gets to it when it's still about a foot open, you know?
It's ridiculous. And there's a slightly different reprise too between episodes two. There's no Doctor in part three, linear part three.
Yeah, and you don't get the crash zoom on Mary Tam going, Doctor! Which is a bit of a shame, you know. There's always room for a crash zoom of Mary Tam.
Yeah.
Every shot in this story should be a crash zoom of Mary Tam.
I agree.
It would have been better, much better.
Now, the Shadow, who is not the Master, but the agent of the Black Guardian.
He has two noses.
Yes, he does.
One nose on top of the other, the actor's nose and then the skull head nose. I think he looks pretty good, actually, and he has a great voice. But he's so generic. I mean, he's just sort of terribly boring. And part of it is the arc, you know, which is presented in its least subtle way as a sort of battle between good and evil. You know, we've got to get the key to time and give it to the good guy so the evil guy doesn't get hold of it. You know, all of that's sort of very boring. And so the Shadow can't help but be boring. I mean, you complained earlier, Todd, that he'd come up with the idea of just sitting there waiting for the Doctor to turn up with the key. I actually think that was a good way of keeping the Black Guardian out of the plot of any of the previous stories.
Well, that's a good point, Nathan. Otherwise, he might have had, like, the Doctor versus some sort of agent, but...
Yeah, there's no agents. Like, they flirt with the idea very briefly in Rebus Operation, don't they?
Yeah, and Stones of Blood, Cesare implies that she might know what's going on, but doesn't say it overtly.
That never really occurred to me, like, as a kid or even now, like, you know, that they could have put an agent in there. Like, it just, he just sits there. And he literally, is the guy really old? Like, yeah, he just sits there most of the time.
I think he was about 68 or something like that. He was quite old, you know, for... Yeah, 70 standards, that's quite old. Yeah, I'm sure he was born in 1910 or something like that, so he was 67, 68.
Has he been in anything else? Do we know him? What's his name?
His name is William Squire, and he did have quite a long tradition. He was a bit like Valentine Dahl, who will turn up at the end of this story as well, spoiler alert. But he had a long tradition of sort of playing characters with very mellifluous voices and what have you.
But it's so boring, like these two episodes where he just talks about getting the key to time, and then walks a bit, and then sits a bit, and then he has his pathetic guards, and it just drives my head in. These three and four are really a struggle to get through. They really are.
What about the long scene of K-9 and Mentalis beeping at each other?
Why does K-9 spin around? Like a spinning top, it's insane.
And the Doctor says, I've never seen him do that before. Oh no, not like five
not
stories ago
planet.
In the Pirate Planet. There is one good thing about that scene, and it's something my brother actually picked up on once when we were watching it together, and that's when Romana's really intrigued by it, and, oh, it's like the Dance of the Bees, and Merrick's like, what are bees? Insects with stings in their tails. The Doctor is annoyed because someone is messing around with his dog.
Really?
Which is a very human thing. It's like, how dare you mess around with my dog?
So that's why he says that line, the bee thing, like so snappy. Because I've written in my notes here, why does Tom say it's so snappy? Yeah. Sorry, guys, I just... this is out there. This is the sort of level of intellect you have on the podcast when I'm around.
But, yeah, that's why. It's because someone is messing about with his dog. Maybe. Or,
it's
you
such
know...
such a boring scene.
As Tom has always said, what he loved most about the Doctor was working with other actors. What has he got for this recording session? He's got Merak and he's got Shap, who's played by David Harries. And by this point, David Harries retires from acting after the first studio recording block.
Like, has he been in something else? Like other shows?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Something?
He's Doran in that terrible Blake 7 episode, Moloch.
Oh, okay, I know he, I'd seen
he's Villa's friend. He's a psychopath.
Oh, of course. Sorry, this is out there. I know who he is now.
Yeah.
Because his face is so recognisable. And I quite like the early stuff, but then it just, in episode four, he does some stupid...
Like comedy pratfall.
Oh, yeah. I'm just there going, episode four, the whole thing is... By episode four, everything's falling apart. Mm. Who's the pilot in the ship?
That's Pat Gorman.
Pat Watch. He's been in it before, hasn't he?
He has. He's like a Silurian or two.
Is it Romana that suggests to the Doctor to put the Key to Time together with a fake piece?
Yeah, I really like that, actually. That's the one idea that I like.
Yeah, and I think it's very clever. And it's like, it never have thought to come to me. Like, you put it together and then, you know, make a fake piece to have the whole thing going. And I actually do like the whole idea of the countdown. it's very monotonous.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that that's actually pretty good. And given that, you know, we're actually not going to see the Key to Time actually do anything. You know, we've been searching for it all year. And then it breaks, the Doctor breaks it, you know, before he gives it to the Guardian. There's no resolution, nothing's going to happen. Yeah. So we do at least get to see the Key in action. And that is quite fun.
It is the most obvious use of polystyrene since it's some rocks fell on Joe's head on the planet Spiridon.
It's really bad polystyrene, isn't it?
I do have to say that Bob Baker and Dave Martin miss a trick with the Key to Time, because something we've always said about them is that they have so many ideas and they play with them and then they chuck them away. When they put the Key to Time together, their only time for it is to throw around a time loop. You know, why not have some other time travel things in there? Why not get the video disc player out and run some time backwards and things like that?
Could have been like another time monster.
Yeah, why not?
Well, they had used time loops before, back in The Claws of Axos, which they wrote. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They're mining their own past, you know.
Well, this is perhaps appropriate. Is it a good time to mention that this is the last time they write together on anything?
They fight, don't they? They have a lover's quarrel or something?
Well, all the reports are that they just decided after 11 years to write separately. And, of course, Dave Martin is no longer with us, but Bob Baker says that there was never any animosity. It was just a mutual decision to dissolve the partnership.
So there is a solo story yet to come
from Bob Baker, that's right.
Which one is it?
The Nightmare of Eden.
Oh, that's actually not so bad.
Exactly.
It's a pretty reasonable script.
But, and I haven't said this for a while, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
So going back to where we were in episode 4, Canine gets his own little adventure to go on, which is boring as. We've got the Marshal on repeat, boring. Mm. But we do get the two Romanas together. Well, yes. Not quite yet. It's really weird seeing Mary Tam and Lala Ward together on screen.
It's just like Day of the Doctor. It's the Day of Romana.
If only that had happened. But it is weird seeing them both together. It doesn't freak me out, but it's just like, oh, it's just strange. It's just weird.
Mm. And they do bounce off each other quite well. Apparently they got on very well behind the scenes too. They both had a very wicked sense of humour, which led to Mary Tam christening Lala Ward as Princess Disastra. And Lala Ward returning the favour with Trattoria Romana.
That's brilliant. I like that.
I can see from your facial expression and the fact that we're talking about episode 4, I know what you're about to talk about.
What, episode 5? Because I just want to get through episode 4.
Does Drax turn up at the end of episode 4?
I know he's in episode 5.
Yeah.
Okay. So episode 5, we get another Time Lord in Drax. Who is Cockney? No.
Yeah, Cockney.
He's Cockney, and he's wearing, what the hell is he wearing?
Space clothes.
Yeah, it's a space jumpsuit. It's a space shell suit. Yeah.
I thought it was more like if you're on a motorbike or something.
Yeah.
Maybe his TARDIS is disguised as a motorbike. In the later book, the later Choose Your Own Adventure book by Dave Martin, Search for the Doctor, Drax's TARDIS is in the form of a pink Cadillac.
Oh, God, they're horrible.
Thank you so much. So he calls the Doctor Theta Sigma, is that right?
Fate of Sigma.
So what do you think of him?
He's really terrible.
See, the actor or the character?
The actor can't do natural hand gestures or anything or kind of talk normally. So it's like a really bizarrely affected performance. And it's clearly intended to be funny, but just really isn't. I've got no objection to the idea. I'm just watching Brendan's face because the moment I finish this sentence, he's going to leap in and say how much he likes Drax.
You're right.
And so do I.
See, I really like, I agree with you that the comedy is very laboured. So I think where the comedy comes from is the interplay with Tom, and especially the reactions with Tom, because at this point, of course, Tom Baker and Doctor Who are pretty much one and the same. So you've got the Doctor B looking incredibly uncomfortable that someone is coming in and stealing his show. Yeah. Because that is what Drax does. You know, I think he is this likable, he's a larger-than-life character, and there is at least an explanation as to why he sounds so ridiculously halfpenny Dick Van Dyke Cockney.
He was in prison?
He was in prison in Brixton, so he had to learn to speak the lingo night.
It's very demotic.
I think it lifts the story.
Yeah.
And I like his performance generally. I think the character does some really stupid things. He talks about Gallifrey. Right?
Well, everyone's pronouncing it Gallifrey.
They've been doing that for a while now. But, you know, this episode, of course, K-9 is possessed in this episode and calls the Doctor, Doctor. Like, I mean, it's just so obvious that he's possessed.
Yeah.
And notes Drax's silliness. Your silliness is noted. How does that go, Brendan?
Your silliness has been noted.
Very good. I've jumped past, of course, the cliffhanger to episode 4-5, which is the Shadow going, the key to time is mine, ha ha ha.
That's really boring.
Which is just boring.
And is that because he's left the door open? Is that why the key to time is his?
Yes, and then he goes to try and get it, and then we get those three flashes of light where he sort of goes, flails back and back. What is that?
I don't know. And then one of his mutes kicks up the carpet on the way into the TARDIS. That's a famous blooper that's still being wheeled out by ITV for their TV Gone Wrong specials.
They could just show the Armageddon Factor for the TV Gone Wrong special, couldn't they?
Well, of course,
you do get multiple Marys in this episode calling the Doctor, you know.
Doctor, Doctor. Doctor.
Yeah, very seductive, but only for about 15 seconds.
That 15 seconds adds up to the two episodes that are really good in this story.
You've got to multiply those 15 seconds by the number of Marys involved in order to...
I love how horrified the Doctor is by the concept of so many Romanas telling him he's wrong and piloting the TARDIS properly.
She actually asks him in episode one way back then whether he... didn't they teach him anything at the academy, which I think is really that's terrifically good. Their relationship's developed, you know, such as it is.
And of course it's from episode 4 and 5 where we get those famous BBC VT clips from the BBC Christmas tapes with lots of bloopers from Tom and Mary, such as how long till detonation K9, insufficient data. Yeah, you never know the answer when it's important, do you? And
really?
And several bloopers where Tom and Mary flub their dialogue and just look at each other and go in for a kiss.
Oh, I have seen that. Is that on the DVD?
Yeah, it's on the DVD. It's from rehearsal footage because Mary's still got her hair up in rollers.
Is that the one where he asks what for Christmas, Doctor? And he just looks over at Mary.
Yeah, that's the one. That was recorded. What BBC VT was, it was a yearly tape shown at the BBC Christmas party, and it was a collection of bloopers and also skits. So, for instance, Tom looking at Mary as what he wanted for Christmas was a specially recorded skit, whereas You Never Know the Answer When It's Important was a blooper from the technical rehearsal,
right,
where they could afford to have flubs and whatnot. Because, of course, another big problem in this story is with no location filming and almost no model or pre-filming, instead of having to record the equivalent of, say, 35 to 40 minutes worth of studio in one studio session, they had to record 50 minutes.
Okay, because they're shooting virtually two entire episodes.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's not an excuse, but that's just pointing out why you get moments like kicking up the carpet.
It's also in this episode, I think... Merrick falls down a hole. Very interestingly shot with the camera lens and that sort of thing, where it's not really a hole when they're looking down. I never quite understood how that worked.
Or what's even going on.
But as a kid, I always remember, and when I came back to this, I always remember, oh, he's the wet one that keeps calling out the asteroid all the time. But it's actually quite late in the story that he starts doing that. But it always sticks in my mind. Like the last episode and a half, that's all he's doing.
He is a bit wet, as you say, Leah Nathan, but he's not too bad at the beginning. And he gets that wonderful moment with Tom and Mary where, you know, he's in the room and Astra's disappeared and he's really, really distraught. And the Doctor and Romana are like, what, why? What's wrong? What are you doing here? Because I love her. And they both just look incredibly sort of, that's a thing.
So we get to the end of the episode. The Doctor gets... shot by Drax because the guard has opened, the TARDIS door is open and the guard's going to go in or something like that.
Am I
wrong?
Yeah, no, the door's open.
The door's Drax open. Shoots him. And so Drax, rather than shooting the guard, shoots the Doctor and himself. But the gun shrinks anyway. Like, surely the gun should not shrink
Like as a country, shoots
like I don't understand.
That's brilliant. That's never occurred
yeah,
to me.
Never I'm just there going, this is insane. Like this is one of their ideas, you know. And it's like, well, surely the gun should be the same size. You shot that. Oh, anyway.
Okay, so why does that happen? That they shoot themselves so that they can do the Trojan horse thing with K-9.
Well, the doctor actually wants him to shoot the guard. No, and because he doesn't shoot the guard, they do the Trojan horse thing.
Why do Bob and Dave do it? Do you know what I mean?
Because they've got an episode to go.
Yeah, yeah. It feels
well, they haven't shrunk anyone this episode, and they thought, well, shrinking worked so well last time we did shrinking.
Yeah,
I think
yeah,
this is too. Where the door is open.
Yeah.
And then this is the light that affects the shadow. Why does the light affect the shadow?
Because he's the shadow.
Yeah.
Like, he mentions that he's been waiting for Princess Astra to be born. So does that mean he's been waiting for generations after generations?
Yeah.
Thousands of years. It's so boring. He must be so bored. He must be like those people on board the R14 or whatever it is. What's that called?
R1C? R1C.
The Argo.
Mm. Look, all I can say is, like, we get to this point in the story and, like, it feels like 1,000 years. It really does. And it is boring. It's like, I just wanted to finish.
The one thing, I've said that I like the time loop and the key to time thing. The other thing that I do like, I guess, and it doesn't really go anywhere, is that Princess Astra is the sixth segment. And so they're all kind of statues and baubles and things up to this point, aren't they, really?
Yeah. So we had...
Lump of Jethric, Planet Calufrax, Pendant...
Then we had a statue head.
Yeah. Then the symbol of Kroll's power, which...
We don't know whether it changed shape or not before Kroll ate it, or if it was just sitting around as a crystal. I mean, it was probably an amulet or something.
Yeah, yeah. So they're all amulets, but this one's an actual person. And so there's a sort of moral dilemma here about, you know, like, to fulfil their mission, they have to kind of sacrifice Astra.
And they do have an argument about that. And, and it's probably the last bit of character development that Mary Tamer's Romana gets, because she goes from being very aloof and not really caring about people in the Rybos operation to now saying, you know, now we're murderers and we've killed someone. And then the Doctor has to point out the bigger picture to her. So the roles from their first meeting are kind of reversed.
I wonder who wrote that. Because, like, okay, so Bob Baker and Dave Martin have delivered their script, but whether or not they actually did that dialogue, I mean, Anthony Reed's out the door as script editor. He's leaving the show.
Adams even does some work on episode 6, doesn't he?
Douglas Adams does work at the end to wrap everything up. The last scenes in the TARDIS, I believe, are his.
Yep.
And I think that's part of the reason why this story may be, I mean, it was always not going to be great, written by these two, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, when you're leaving a job, in the last few weeks of the job, you do what you need to do and you go, well, I'll leave the rest, you know, for who's ever going to come after me. And so, you know, Anthony Reed's decided to leave as script editor.
Yeah.
The Baker boys have delivered a script that is workable. How much work is he really going to do on it, you know? Enough to make sure that it's perfunctory up to a point, and then it's like, well, I'm leaving, you know?
It is. I mean, you know, we all think of The Key to Time as this big overarching theme, and you know, all the DVDs get released in one big box set and all of that sort of thing. Yeah. But I actually find it hard to believe that anyone working on the show thought of it like that at all.
Yeah, I mean, Graham Williams had this idea that he wanted to do a season-long arc as soon as he came in, but he couldn't get it together for season 15. But it's like he didn't really get it together here either. You know, no. He just gives everyone this concept of you need to have this crystal in your story that the Doctor and Romana are hunting for, do whatever else you like.
Well, I mean, you know, the advantage of it is it gets the Doctor to do something. Like, he's in every place for a reason. Mm. And, you know, the following year it will be, you know, the randomizer, which just means that he turns up somewhere random like he did for the first few years of the show. Yeah. So he's concerned about not having to provide the Doctor with a reason for being, a new novel reason for being in the story every, you know, like every story. But, you know, the fact that they hadn't thought about how they were going to wrap it up, that Anthony Reed didn't have an idea of what was going to happen. And the end is terrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Look, I agree with you. It's like they sat down and they said, this is what it's all about, you know, they're on this mission, blah, 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 blah. But then the document was never finished to say, well, how are we going to conclude it? They never really thought through that concluding thing, which I just think is so important. I mean, they're going to make the same mistake in several years' time with the trial of a Time Lord, where, oh, yes, we'll do this trial, and then, well, they haven't really thought about how they're going to wrap it up. It's just, you know, and it's just, it really undermines everything that's been going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's been an entertaining season. The individual stories have been great. Even the idea of having them hunting for segments of the Key to Time, that's quite good in the individual stories. But when they get the Key to Time...
You just want more. You get that one sequence where the Doctor's, you know, saying, well, the White Guardian's had enough time now to do whatever he needs to do, or the time to reset, or whatever it talks about. And then, you know, he commands the whole thing to stay where it is, and then... By breaking the tracer, the whole thing gets scattered back, you know, to wherever. It seems pointless. I don't know, pointless, but...
Yeah, it does seem pointless. The fact that that getting the Key to Time and having the Guardian fix everything is just dealt with in a line of dialogue.
And what's the deal with the Guardians? Like, I mean, they can't touch them. Did they set them up as a little game for themselves to find the jigsaw puzzle thing, or is it some higher being above them? Like, there's questions that are unanswered.
It is described as Guardian technology, so the implication is that the Guardians created the key.
Just so they're like playing a game of chess and like, I'm going to win this week, there's a bit more goodness in the universe, and next week, well, I'm in charge, so there's a bit more evil happening.
Like, yeah, well, I mean, none of that makes any sense at all, does it? Just no sense.
I have a few answers to some script questions you raised.
Ooh.
Good.
Now, first of all, a moral dilemma in the final episodes as we discover that Astra is the sixth segment of the Key to Time. The original sixth segment in the Bob Baker and Dave Martin scripts was the shadow of the shadow. So the shadow's own shadow was the sixth segment. So he'd been waiting around all this time only to discover that the segment was within him all along.
Oh,
so Anthony Reed changed that.
Well, thank you, Anthony. That was a good move.
Yeah.
Don't thank him too quickly.
Oh, okay. What's happening next?
Well, you know how we were talking about, isn't it a shame that there are no Zeons on Zeos?
He axed them, didn't he?
He axed them. It wasn't in consultation with Bob Baker and Dave Martin. He just cut them out of the script and substituted Mentalis.
I'll say, well, Mentalis wasn't even their idea.
No.
It just seems like a Bob Baker and Dave Martin idea in that it's sort of pointless and over fairly quickly.
So he's done some work on this script.
Yeah, so literally the first 5.5 episodes are his, and the last half of episode 6 is Douglas Adams and Graham Williams.
Script editing.
And especially that last scene, because in Anthony Reed / Bob Baker and Dave Martin's version, it's much the same. So the Doctor disperses the Key to Time, blah, 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 except the Guardian doesn't even show up. The Doctor just has his little bit about, I can do anything because I possess the Key to Time.
That is terrible. The director needed to give him a good slap for...
Well, that's all right. Mary Tam did instead.
Yeah. That's good. I like when she whacks him on the shoulder. Yeah.
But, they just had the Doctor going, oh, you know what, this is too powerful, snap, and all over.
We see, I mean, even that would have been something, you know, like the rejection of the arc, the idea that there's someone like a White Guardian who can be given the Key to Time, that's a coherent idea or even a desirable idea, some old white guy, in an unconvincing garden somewhere, that he's the arbiter of what's good and right and he should have ultimate power to, you know, impose his vision of the universe on everyone, you know, like a proper wholehearted rejection of that idea. Instead, you get this sort of muddy thing where maybe Valentine dials the Black Guardian or the White Guardian or something, and it's all just a huge incoherent mess.
Look, at least he's there. Like, I think it would have been terrible if there'd been no Guardian and it just ended.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and of course it does end. It ends for this version of Romana. She does get a nice line at the end, I think Mary does. Like, you know, the Doctor talks about, nobody knows where they're going. And she gets to say, not even us. Mm. I just love that delivery. And I think it ends on her, actually.
Oh, no, doesn't Tom ruin it by laughing into the camera?
Yeah, that's right.
As usual.
As usual. Perhaps it was wish fulfillment. I wanted it to end on her.
I like how she tells him off.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful.
Look, this is... dull and pedestrian and dire at times, many times. I still prefer to watch this story than Underworld and The Invisible Enemy.
That's not exactly a ringing endorsement.
Maybe not, but it's Mary Tam that keeps me going throughout this entire thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, as we say goodbye to Bob Baker and Dave Martin, we head perhaps appropriately into our Jenny Laird Awards for Most Puzzling Creative Choice. So, gentlemen, are we going to shoot fish in a barrel or are we going to go for someone else?
Who are we shooting?
Bob Baker and Dave Martin would be the obvious choice. I'm going to go out there and actually choose someone who I've spent the last 12 weeks of our podcast vehemently defending for the most part. I'm going to choose Graham Williams because he had this vision for Doctor Who where he wanted the Doctor to have responsibility and he wanted the Doctor to have a mission, and he found it morally abhorrent that the Doctor could just goof off around the universe without having any sort of mission. But he himself doesn't come up with a coherent vision for that. You know, he doesn't come up with a proper story arc. You know, even if he'd just come up with the setup and come up with the last two episodes, as you suggest, Todd, you know, we really should have had two episodes to wind this all up. Two episodes with the Guardians, you know?
Bit of location work, something.
Yeah. Put us in a proper garden. Give us a sort of half illusory sequence like The Deadly Assassin Part 3. Give us something, Graham. I know you're under a lot of pressure, and of course he's no longer with us. And I love his work on the series. I love his individual stories. But I think maybe even he realised that a story arc was a bad idea because, of course, he doesn't develop one for next year. So, sadly, as much as I love him, Graham Williams is my choice for my Jenny Laird for Most Puzzling Creative Choice.
I'm going to give it to Anthony Reid, his script editor, who I generally really love. But the fact that he employed Bob Baker and Dave Martin to write the conclusion of this season, why? Just why? Couldn't you have got somebody else? I mean, really, honestly, why? Nathan, of course, is going to come up with something far more interesting and witty, aren't you?
I wouldn't count on it.
It's either that, or I have to give it to the Tara and Wood Beast.
I did consider that.
I love the Tara and Wood Beast.
But at least with the Tara and Wood Beast, you know, they minimised its exposure as much as possible.
Or I might give it to the sunset behind Tom and Mary in The Stones of Blood when they're on the top of the cliff. That's pretty crummy.
The constantly moving sunset. It's too much methane in the atmosphere.
Yes, I'm giving mine to Richard McMahon Smith. He is the designer on the Armageddon Factor.
Ah, the set designer.
Yeah, we're just the designer, you know,
yeah.
Not makeup or anything like that. But season 15 really showed its budgetary limitations at times with things like The Invisible Enemy and obviously Underworld. But season 16 hasn't really suffered from that until maybe Power of Krull, although that has, you know, like lavish location work. Here we're stuck in a series of, as Todd pointed out, really very boring corridors. And there's really nothing sort of remarkable or memorable about the production really to speak of at all. I think it's a really drab way to end what has visually been a really fun and, you know, generally successful season.
There's a great moment on the commentary of the Armageddon Factor. This isn't my recommendation, but do listen to it if you can. The Mary Tam, John Woodvine and Michael Hayes commentary. I think at the end of episode 6, Mary Tam says, "Well, that was almost as knackering as making the Armageddon Factor."
Oh, God, I love her.
I think she's on a second commentary on it with Tom as well. Because that was one of the ones. That's one of the ones on the UK edition, which has two commentaries. Okay, my pick for this season. I was tempted to go with Big Finish's Key to Time trilogy.
That's the number two, right?
That's the number two.
Please don't, because it's awful.
Oh,
sorry.
I quite enjoy it. I understand why people don't. It's very frivolous. It's like shoving Peter Davison into a bunch of season 17 stories. So it doesn't.
Wait, what is it? What's the premise?
The premise is that when
Key to Time is back.
Yeah, when the Doctor broke up the Key to Time, its work had not been done, so he needs to go out and find it again. But instead of having...
Pete needs
to go out and find it again, and he's paired up with a new companion who is a human tracer called Amy, And she's also got a sister, Zara. So we've got the A to Z thing again.
Oh, dear.
It's all coming back to me. It was a horrible nightmare listening to it.
They ended up going on to their own series called Graceless, which won several awards. Yeah.
What, from Big Finish themselves?
Yeah, from Big Finish.
Won their own awards?
Yes. No, not from...
Sorry, I said that up.
Simon Guerrier, if you're listening, I think you're lovely and a very talented writer. But yes, also, and also Lala Ward comes back in that as the Lord President. So they are good. But what I'm going to recommend over that is the last Doctor Who work that Mary Tam undertook before she passed away. She did a series of 7 two-parters with Tom and John Leeson. I'm going to recommend one in particular, and that's the first one called The Antimatter.
It's a pun.
And it's the Doctor and Romana, but particularly Romana, thrust into a P.G. Woodhouse, Jeeves and Worcester style 1920s comedy.
Wow.
Also featuring Julia McKenzie.
Oh, really? Terrific.
The Antimatter.
The Antimatter.
It's the only one I haven't listened to of that range for some reason. I don't have it.
Yeah, do listen to it. It's the first in the... I mean, they're all great because it's all Mary. And the whole series really seeks to redress what Mary thought was a weakness in her character, in that they didn't explore the fact that she was alien and she was psychic and she was incredibly clever, and all the stories do that. There's a story that pairs her up with Henry Gordon Jago.
Of course.
And it also addresses the fact that, you know, she's a beautiful woman, probably. So there are several men over the course of the series who are interested, and she just shuts them down brilliantly in each case. So any of those are good, but The Antimatter is my pick from that range.
Well, look, I recommend Mary Tam in The Sealess from Safe from The Companion Chronicles from Big Finish. She also does another one as well. You know, it's just to hear more of her as Romana. Just brilliant.
And both of those audios are available for download from the Big Finish website. The downloads are very affordable. So, for instance, The Antimatter, which is a full-cast one-hour play, is $9 to download, Australian. And The Stealers from Safe, which is Mary Tam giving a tour de force playing about 10 different people, is only $8 Australian to download.
I'm going to pick something a bit different. One of my favourite websites is avclub.com, the Onion AV Club. So you know The Onion, which is a sort of satirical newspaper that's published in America. It's sort of terribly funny. They have some companion sites, and one of them is the AV Club. And I think the AV Club is really some of the cleverest writing about, you know, TV and movies and things like that on the internet. And so it's a place I go fairly frequently for news and things. And they have, for a while, had someone reviewing classic Doctor Who. And he stopped reasonably recently. I'm not quite sure why. And he was just going from story to story, you know, more or less at random. But having, like, an American website where a fairly insightful reviewer, and I can't remember his name, but I will put it in the show notes, you know, writes intelligent commentary on Doctor Who from a position of knowledge, you know, that's pretty rare. And one of the great things about the AV Club is that the commenters are really funny and really clever. So it's not one of those, it's not like a YouTube comments thread where you want to, you know, go and purge after reading it. It's full of just really witty, clever people commenting on Doctor Who, and so it's really fun. They continue to review the new series.
I've just recently read a couple of those. A friend of mine sent a link to me, and I thought they were very good. Yeah. So, yeah.
But it's a good website generally, you know, not just for Doctor Who, but for just following any sort of pop culture, both English and American. So I can really recommend it.
Thankfully, dear listener, that's all the time we have for the Armageddon Factor before we get locked in a time loop. Thankfully, dear listener, that's all the time we have for the Armageddon Factor before we get locked in a time loop. We will be back next week to discuss Destiny of the Daleks. Todd, you will of course rejoin us 6 weeks later to discuss The Leisure Hive, which you look very happy about.
In the 1980s! Yay!
Well, you are from 1980. So Richard will be rejoining us for possibly the campest season of Doctor Who ever. That's also taking into account later appearances by John Sim. Until then, please check us out online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. And don't forget, over on Bondfinger, we now have commentaries for Dr. No from Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, and You Only Live Twice. Until then, may none of your gearads be 8 foot tall. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. This episode, Holden Astra, was recorded on the 7th of November 2015. The next episode will be released on January 17th. We respectfully dedicate this episode to the memory of Mary Tam and her husband Marcus Ringrose, who both passed away in 2012.
And that's including appearances by John Sim. That's including any later appearance. That's